today on Doomed. That's right, it's time for
WrestleMania
this Sunday. So that means it's time for a very special pro wrestling and progressive politics episode of Doomed. And whether you're a fan or not, smart, mark, or casual watcher, this episode has something for you. Joining me today for a very special Fatal 4-Way conversation, sports editor at The Nation, Dave Zirin, Australian pro wrestling writer Scarlett Harris, and pro wrestling writer at Deadspin, David Bixenspan. We're talking the women's wrestling revolution, wrestling and workers' rights, the Ultimate Warrior, China, and so much more on today's episode of Doom with Matt Binder. Before we get to the wrestling talk, let me remind you how you can support this program.
Ooh, yeah!
Tell all your friends. Share the show online. Seriously. Twitter, Facebook, for this episode specifically, the Squared Circle subreddit. Yeah, those are great ways to spread the word about this show. Word of mouth, it works wonders. Leave a 5-star rating and a written review on iTunes. All the cool kids are doing it, and now you can support this show monetarily. That's right.
It's all about the money. It's all about the money.
It's April, so that means Patreon member bonuses are on the way. Sign up for only $5 a month at patreon.com/mattbinder. Now, without any further ado...
What a rush.
All right, everybody. As you may or may not know, I know some of you who listen to this might not be as big of a pro wrestling fan as I am, but this is WrestleMania week. With WrestleMania being this Sunday, WrestleMania is like the Super Bowl of pro wrestling. It's a WWE event that happens every year. And this is a big one. This is WrestleMania 34. I almost had a mental block there and did not say 34. It is 34, right, guys?
Yes. Well, they're not using the number anymore because Vince thinks it makes them look old.
All right. Yeah.
Technically, it's just WrestleMania or WrestleMania New Orleans or whatever.
Right, right. So let me introduce the people who you're hearing. This is like a fatal four-way match here, guys. This is we got three other people on this podcast with me today. First, we have Dave Zirin. He is the sports editor at The Nation, host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and you can follow him on Twitter at Edge of Sports. Dave, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, thank you for being here. Next up, we have Scarlett Harris. She's an Australian freelance writer with a focus on pro wrestling. You can see her writing at her website, scarletwoman.com.au. Very Australian there. And you can find her on Twitter at Scarlett E. Harris. Scarlett, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And then finally, he's been on the show before to talk about the XFL. We won't be talking about the XFL today. David Bixenspan, pro wrestling writer at Deadspin and co-host of the Between the Sheets podcast. Follow him on Twitter at David Bix. To make life easy, because there's two Daves and Davids on this show today, from this moment forward, he's just going to be known as Bix.
I'm used to it. It's
all right.
Okay.
All right.
We should probably point out, though, for people who haven't been keeping up with it, new XFL looks like it's probably not happening, or at least it feels that way.
Really?
Oh, you didn't see this. Dick Ebersol's son is starting his own spring football league a year earlier and with all the same ideas, just more fleshed out. Yes, Vince McMahon's buddy's son, so... No one really knows what happened yet, but...
Wow, I did not hear this.
Yeah.
All right, no more XFL, though. This is Pro Wrestling Week. This is the week where us wrestling fans can just, you know, be wrestling fans, and everyone just has to deal with it, because that's what this week's about. And what I want to start with, actually, I want to talk about this. I always think of this match when WrestleMania comes up, because it is probably, to me, one of the biggest
wrestling storyline, which we won't just be talking about storylines here. We'll be talking about, you know, angles and storylines and the business. And I'll try to, you know, if we get too into the weeds here, I'll just stop us and try to make sure any lay person who is listening to this can follow along.
Wait, quick question. Are we talking about the business or this business?
Both. We're going to be talking Mr. McMahon and Vince McMahon for sure. But right here, we're talking about storyline. And this one will always bother me to the end of time. And it's the lead up and match at WrestleMania 19 between Booker T and Triple H.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is one of the biggest travesties in pro wrestling history. First of all, this is a... does anyone want to pick up and discuss this angle and bring us through it?
Sure. So Booker T, for those who don't know, is a black gentleman who, as a teenager, was convicted of armed robbery, robbing a Wendy's, turns his life around, finds a guy who even, I think he was his boss, who paid for him to go to wrestling school, and now, you know, fine, upstanding citizen. But when WrestleMania 19 happened 15 years ago, this past Friday, he was only like a year removed from the information about the armed robbery really coming out online, thanks to, I think, the smoking gun. And Triple H, who at the time is the champion, and did Triple H have the old school handlebar mustache at this point? I don't remember.
He might have.
Okay.
That is one of the important parts of this story.
Well, and also that Triple H has a, on a lot of his stuff, his logo is basically an Iron Cross, but slightly modified, so WWE can say it's not an Iron Cross.
Right.
And he cuts this promo, gives an interview, because we're going to avoid wrestling. I use cut a promo, though, if they're not being interviewed by someone. And since in WWE, people know what a promo is. Okay. On Booker T, where he talks about the criminal stuff. And
just to back up a bit, Booker T has won a battle royal to an over-the-top battle royal to become the number one contender for Triple H's championship. And
yes,
the
he
championship
has earned a title shot definitively.
At WrestleMania. And he eliminates The Rock as the last person to it's down to The Rock and Booker T, and Booker T eliminates The Rock to get this shot against Triple H. Triple H is currently holding the World Heavyweight title, a title that was just handed to him by Eric Bischoff. So we do have what sounds like can be an incredibly progressive wrestling storyline. We have Triple H, the husband of the boss's daughter, handed a title. He just handed it to him. And then Booker T, this guy who's worked his whole life to get to this point, and they're both meeting each other at WrestleMania. Now, if I'm hearing this and did not see this match yet and did not see any build-up to it, I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be incredible.
But Triple H talks about how people like you don't get to be champion in WWE. You're not a wrestler. You're an entertainer. Dance for me, Booker, I believe is one of the lines. And also makes mention of his, quote, nappy hair. Now, you're thinking, Booker T avenges this and wins the title and is triumphant, big celebration at WrestleMania.
That would be, you know, I'm one of those people. Before, you know, there's going to be some, it might be some people listening to this going, oh, social justice warriors are going to, SJWs are going to complain that.
But not storytelling.
This was even a storyline. You know, I'm fine with this storyline. I'm cool with it if we get to the point where there is a message. There is a point to bringing up this stuff that serves a purpose.
Yes. So you also need to look at the bigger context of WrestleMania 19. All or almost all of the big matches on the show, or at least the top three matches on the show. The other title match, if you're not a wrestling fan, don't ask why there are two world titles. Brock Lesnar has to hit his finishing move three times to beat Kurt Angle. Right. In the biggest non-title match of the show, The Rock has to use his finishing move three times to beat Steve Austin. Booker T and Triple H has to hit his finishing move once lay down for 20 seconds without doing anything, and then pins Booker T to win.
Right. So this is actually, from what I remember, an incredible match. And Booker probably has one of his best showings, I believe. You know, he was incredible in this match. And you think that with the storyline as it was, maybe they would be like, you know, Booker's basically at this point was the guy who carried the WCW portion of the invasion. I mean, they didn't bring in any of the big guys at this point who for the invasion angle. And so Booker was basically the guy who carried that storyline for WCW. He, without a doubt, was the breakout star of all the WCW guys they did bring in. He has this incredible backstory that obviously Triple H brings up as the heel to attack him. But for most people, would probably be an inspiring tale of somebody working to get to where they want to be in life and making it to the top. You know, what people like to hear, that type of stuff. And they just have him lose to Triple H in one of the, you know, like you mentioned, when we're at WrestleMania and we're in the main event, it's difficult to pin someone usually. Triple H hits one finishing move and then slowly covers Booker T and wins. I mean, I'm not someone who likes to go into like fantasy booking or whatever when trying to discuss this stuff, but even if you wanted Triple H to win as a writer or whatever, I feel like there could have been a way where you still had a good message in terms of like, he had multiple interferences, Booker T pins him, but using his connections with Stephanie or something, Triple H has them restart the match over and over again to show that Booker T is actually the better man, but once again, here is the man holding down this guy who's been through everything in life. There was a way to do this if you really wanted to.
Yes.
And they just chose for Triple H to win. Cleanly.
Yes. Yes.
Always will bother me. Always will bother me. I'm getting angry just thinking about it now.
Yes. Well, okay, I have a topic, though. It's not WWE, but I think this is maybe in the grand scheme of even of wrestling topics we could actually talk about, might be in a way the most interesting for people who aren't fans. That so as we go into WrestleMania weekend, for those who aren't fans, you don't know that basically every other wrestling company congregates in the city that has WrestleMania to run shows as well. And the second biggest company in wrestling in America these days is Ring of Honor, which is owned by Sinclair Broadcasting Group.
Right.
That's Sinclair Broadcasting Group.
Right.
But somehow, Ring of Honor is now the most LGBT positive wrestling company.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Right.
Their champion is a implied to be gay guy who comes to the ring with his rent boys, who is a beloved hero, and the biggest non-WWE star in wrestling, who is now a semi-regular, at least going into WrestleMania weekend for Ring of Honor, is an openly bisexual guy doing an implied romantic storyline with his tag team partner.
You know, this is actually, you know, this comes from a company whose champion just maybe what a couple of years ago was Jay Briscoe, who did not have some very nice things to say about the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
So,
although he claimed that was him in character tweeting and not what the real Jason Pugh thought about.
Right, I believe the guy with the Confederate flag on his pants on that one.
I'd love to ask Scarlett, like, if you think and Bix as well. I mean, because this is one of the things that I'm wondering as I'm watching this, particularly when I'm seeing crowds cheer for Velveteen Dream, who is my new favorite everything out in NXT. Is are we seeing a generational shift, and is it being driven by fans, or is it being driven by people like Vince McMahon aging to the point where his kids are taking over, where we're seeing this product that on so many levels we think is art and on so many levels we see is abjectly reactionary, but as we see it is becoming less reactionary as the storylines are being written by younger people and being received by a younger audience?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because I wanted to kind of take the Triple H Booker T match and sort of because that was only my second WrestleMania. Like, I only got into wrestling after WrestleMania 17, so early 2001. So, you know, I was like, you know, in my early teens at that point. So any sort of racial implications of that match were completely over my head at the time. But it, you know, it's sort of, it might be easy given, you know, everything Triple H is involved with now, like NXT and the women's evolution revolution, to sort of be like, well, you know, that was a long time ago. Like, maybe his attitudes have changed and things like that. But what I find interesting is that sort of all of the black characters on WWE TV at the moment are sort of, I don't know, seem to fill in for each other. Like, you know, Booker T was taken off commentary and replaced by Jonathan Coachman. American Alpha broke up and Chad Gable's new partner is Shelton Benjamin. Naomi was given the Kofi-esque spot in the Royal Rumble. And even, you know, those are all sort of main roster examples. But even I think in NXT, which, as we established, Triple H runs, you've got like the Street Profits, which is basically like Crime Time Redux. And you've got Velveteen Dream, who's like, you know, one of my favorite characters as well. But it's like, oh, like he's a black guy. Let's just give him like Prince's gimmick, you know? So maybe all of these things, you know, if they existed in a vacuum, would be okay. But I think that we need to look at the wider optics of like what's going on here. And yeah, it just kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, as much as things have gotten better, it still feels like we're not completely removed from the era where if there were multiple black wrestlers in a given promotion, they had to either be teaming or feuding with each other.
Yeah. Let's talk
about, exactly.
We've got
New Day and Titus Worldwide and stuff. It's just like, it's still very much like that, I think.
Right. No, that's a good point. What would you want to say, Dave?
Well, just really quickly.
I'm sorry. I forgot how our system works.
No, you're bixed, buddy. Yeah. Step back.
Extremely briefly, what makes me feel hopeful is that you have the Usos and the fact that they're Polynesian. That's not their defining characteristic now, even though it was when they first came in. They're the Usos first. I love that Asuka and Shinsuke are Asuka and Shinsuke and aren't, I don't feel like, are otherized to the degree to which Asian wrestlers have been otherized in the past. But the point that Scarlett makes about black wrestlers, I mean, African-American in particular wrestlers, I mean, that can't be made loudly enough. Like, I don't understand why Big E isn't in the world title picture.
Kofi Kingston's been like a sure thing, like someone to depend on. The company constantly knows you need someone with talent, you need someone to go out there and put on a show. Kofi Kingston, your man, both charisma wise he gets over with the fans, he's probably the most talented all around guy on the current roster, and he's nowhere to be seen in the title picture. They never really gave him the shot.
Yeah. Well, they did do that thing with him and Randy Orton.
Yeah, but
how many years ago? And then it just kind of fizzled.
Right. And this was basically, that's when he had to drop the Jamaican accent, right? Because they realized that we can't get this, you know, this guy's, we've been pushing him as a Jamaican guy. He's not. It's going to come across at some point when we put him on the screen more that he's not actually Jamaican. And they gave that ridiculous excuse that he's just a guy that really appreciates Jamaican culture.
Cool. I forgot that part.
Right. No, the thing you brought up about Shinsuke Nakamura and Asuka too, that's something else I wanted to talk about, because, you know, I keep thinking of all these guys, like you said, it's just, these might be the first two Asian pro wrestlers to be in the WWE who aren't defined by being Asian. Like, even when they tried something else with somebody, it was probably even the most racist they've ever been, with Jimmy Wang Yang as the redneck Asian guy.
Well, it was even worse that, okay, like, in a weird
I'll never
way
forget that promo he cut, by the way. It was his introduction promo, and he said, I'm spitballing here, but it was definitely something like this. He said something like, "I may be yellow, but my neck is red." Could not believe it when I was watching it.
I do not remember that actually. But it's even worse though too. Like when I remember when there were first like rumors and reports that like Vince McMahon was mesmerized by hearing Jimmy Yang talk, and that there was this Korean American guy with a Southern accent. You know, everyone thought he was going to be Jimmy Wayne Yang, which is like, okay, you know, it is what it is, but at least, like, you could see why it could be amusing for, like, a minute. But then, no, Jimmy Wang Yang.
Right.
Okay. Sure.
I think we're going to see, to also, again, take something that's incredibly unfortunate, like a bad moment in wrestling, and to also bring up a positive in terms of the progress that we've seen. I think we're going to see our first Asian world champion this Sunday. Asuka's. I totally forgot Asuka's match for the title. Yeah, you're right. Unbelievable.
Be amazing, and the crowd will love it. That's the part that I find the most heartening is, I mean, because as much as we talk about the WWE universe, how they respond to either these racist tropes or the usurping of these racist tropes is really important in determining what we're going to see going forward, particularly as I think Vince McMahon recedes more into the background.
Right. And I want to, something you said about the WWE universe, me and Bix lightly touched on it when we were talking about XFL a few episodes back. But for people who aren't familiar, pro wrestling is no longer this like, the audience is no longer majority white, rednecks from the South, you know, that stereotypical wrestling fan. I would say, and Dave Zirin, you here can probably speak better than at least me and Bix, because I know we're not the biggest sports fans outside of wrestling, where you are. I would say that wrestling fans the wrestling fan base is probably one of the most diverse in gender, race, fan bases in the sports world, if you want to consider wrestling a sport for this conversation.
Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely. And just to point out, like, as someone who, when I was into wrestling as a kid, and then I got into it, and then I went through this period of not being into wrestling, and then back into it in a big way with ECW. And those ECW crowds were like 99% dudes and scary. And it's different now. It's absolutely, it doesn't have to take a backseat to anybody when it comes to the diversity of its audience. I mean, particularly, like, we talk about WWE, but you look at the temple at Lucha Underground, and you look at who's there, and it's amazing. It's all the people that Donald Trump wants to deport together to love wrestling.
Right, right. I was at that Hall of Fame. By the way, Donald Trump is in the WWE Hall of Fame, if you don't know this. I was at that Hall of Fame ceremony in MSG that year.
As was I.
And the crowd hated him more than anybody I've ever seen. And not in like a pro wrestling fan base type of way. In a, I hate you, you shouldn't be here type of way.
Yes. Because, well, this is 2013, so he's already doing the birther stuff.
Right, yes.
At this point. And they did, you know, yeah, it was... Like, that was the only Hall of Fame I've been at live, but even though there have been other times that fans rejected the celebrity inductees, that was by far the worst.
Yeah, but this wasn't just the thing where the wrestling fans aren't happy that this non-wrestler is getting into the Hall of Fame. This was beyond that for Donald Trump, because other celebrities have been inducted, and it was never like that.
Yes. Although they did cheer Ivanka when he asked her to stand up.
Right. Well, that's still wrestling being wrestling in some unfortunate ways when it comes to how they look at women, which is why.
Yes.
We should. Go ahead.
I was just getting. I would add. You know, as far as changing demographics, I mean, the wrestling fan base at large has been shifting toward, you know, more diversity and being heavily Black and Hispanic for a long time, and really, I think we can say has always been fairly heavily Black, but at least in the States, you know, going more Latino is the newer shift. But in terms of like indie wrestling that was aimed towards hardcore fans, I would say the crowds generally were still majority white guys for a long time.
Right.
And yep. I mean, the biggest shift I'm seeing is a lot more female fans at indie shows, but I feel like the most interesting in that sense was in August when Battle Club Pro ran a show at a, I think it was a middle school gym in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. And besides being packed, and this was with the WWE UK division stars as the main attraction, so Tyler Bate, Trent Seven, and Pete Dunne, it was for a crowd that was clearly there to see like the indie hardcore favorites and reacting to them and all that, by far the most diverse I've ever seen. And given like all the stuff you used to see from, like, I remember years ago on the old Ring of Honor message board, fans who didn't want to go to New York City because the previous time they had went there, quote, black people in cars were looking at them.
What?
Yeah, I wish it was still on the internet so I could give more details. But yeah, to go from that to like huge, heavily diverse crowd in freaking Bed-Stuy, I think is a fairly big change.
Right.
If I can interject, I went to an indie show in Melbourne on this past Friday, and it's probably the first local show I've been to in about 2 years or so. And it's in the outer suburbs. So, you know, it takes like an hour to get there. And it was, the crowd was just horrendous. I brought a bunch of like six other people, only one of whom is a wrestling fan. The rest were, you know, it was their first or second experience of wrestling. And, you know, it was a diverse group of friends, you know, some queer people, some people of color. And they were like, we don't want to come back here because, you know, the crowds were just chanting, you know, they were slut shaming the women's matches. They were calling, you know, some of the guys like the F word, and there were racist chants and things as well. And it was just like, you know, one of my last wrestling shows was I went to SummerSlam this past year. And yeah, as you were saying, Bix, like the diversity there, like everyone I was sitting next to was like a person of color. And at this show, like they're all just like white bogans, or if you're not familiar with that term, like Australian rednecks.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you clarified with that.
Yeah. So it's just like, it's still very much that demographic in Australia, I think. And to your point about the UK stars, the next wrestling show I'll go to is Melbourne City Wrestling, which is like our biggest company here and apparently a lot more diverse. I've never been to Melbourne City Wrestling before, but apparently, yeah, the crowds are a lot more progressive and diverse. And there will be, Trent Seven, Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate there and Jimmy Havoc as well. So should be interesting.
Dave, you wanted to say something?
Well, I just wanted to know the term for Australian redneck. I want it like in my, I want to really hear that again if I could.
Oh, bogan, B-O-G-A-N, Finelli.
That's fantastic.
Nice. Now let's actually, though, Scarlett, you mentioned that you got into wrestling, your first WrestleMania. Did you get into wrestling because of WrestleMania 17, or that was just your first WrestleMania?
No, so that was I just missed that. So I think the first show I watched was like the week, you know, the Monday night after. That was like, yes.
And what made you
17 years ago?
Right. And what made you just tune in?
Oh, just had a friend, who was like, hey, do you want to watch wrestling? And I was like, okay. And then I never stopped. Oh, that's a lie. I did stop watching for about 3 or 4 years. From about 2010 to 2013 or 14, but yeah.
I think everyone who watched wrestling has a point where they were just like, I need a break from this. For yep, me, yeah. It was after the invasion angle, and I was just so depressed at how it went. And I was just like, for like 2 years, I was like, I would pay attention online, like go on to the sites and see the results and what was going on. But it was probably the longest stretch where I wasn't actively watching the shows and pay-per-views. It was just like, how did they mess this angle up? The invasion angle, WWE versus WCW.
Yep. That, for me, it was the rise of John Cena, and that plus like the very aggressive sexism of the 2000s. I was just like, there have to be better ways I can spend my time. And then I flipped back. Like, I really think a generation of us flipped back with the CM Punk pipe bomb.
Right.
And the that got outside of wrestling. Like, I saw that pipe. I was only even tangentially familiar with CM Punk. And then I see that, and I was like, okay, I need to see what happens next. I'm in. And that, since then, I've been, yeah, full on.
Let's talk about CM Punk, actually, because I think the, you know, what we have here with CM Punk is a issue of how WWE treats their workers in terms of health and their rights.
And also an aggressively, openly, vocally liberal, straight edge dude.
Yes. And does someone want to take maybe Zyron? Do you want to talk about CM Punk and what happened with him?
Oh no, I'll throw that one to Scarlett. And I'll chime in. I think I serve better that way.
All right, cool. Scarlett, you want to?
Oh God. Okay, pressure's on. Okay. So look. I probably just started getting back into wrestling around the time that he left. So I'll do my best. But didn't he have like a staph infection or something? And the doctor just plied him with antibiotics and sort of ignored his health concerns. And then he ended up with this huge like boil on his back or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he says. I mean, it's clear he had a staph infection, and it's clear that the story of him maybe being misprescribed or not given proper instructions is probably true, because the story he told about, you know, shitting his pants during a TV taping, that's clearly something he didn't, you know, make up or whatever all of a sudden when he did the podcast explaining why he left, because he did tweet about that at the time, and WWE did make him delete it. But it all comes to a head when he gets a concussion in the Royal Rumble, God, 4 years ago now. And the next night, he says they wanted him to take a drug test, and he was sort of annoyed that they were making him take a drug test at that moment while he had just gotten a concussion. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of set everything off, and he walked out. And then they stopped. Apparently, right. What happened was they suspended him for no reason that we really know of. And the story goes, and this was something I had heard before he said it too, was they stopped sending his royalty checks and refused to reissue one that he had forgotten to cash and then expired.
Right. So here's a guy, basically, what it boils down to is a guy who was wrestling injured, knew he had an injury, went to the WWE doctors expecting them to tell him, you know, maybe you should do this, take some time off. And what he got was basically them contorting things so that he continued to work, because they wanted CM Punk, one of the faces of the company, to continue being on all the shows, even if he was injured.
Pretty yeah. much. And there are other stories like this. And there are other stories with staph infections, too. Bob Holly, in his book, talks about getting MRSA. And at the time, I believe, I could look it up, I have it saved somewhere, kind of the doctor being overruled in terms of him having to go on their European tour.
Right.
And then develop, I think it got to the point it might have even been a bone infection of MRSA.
Jeez.
And nearly lost his arm.
Jeez.
I remember hearing about that. He almost lost his arm. Yeah. We could probably, you know, I should probably devote a whole episode to pro wrestling and unions, because there's a long history behind that involving everyone you can think of, from Hulk Hogan to Jesse Ventura. But it's incredible that, you know, basically these guys, in terms of even like their health, in terms of addiction to drugs, that, you know, they take painkillers to get through. Like if CM Punk wasn't straight edge and so strong headed about being that, you know, other guys have no problem doing what they need to, popping whatever they need to continue to work so they don't lose their job, because there is no, you know, there's no guarantee they'll be working for the WWE. And a lot of these guys get addicted. And WWE in recent years have basically put out this company-wide effort where they'll let anyone who ever worked for the WWE, and they've even extended it to people in the wrestling business who haven't worked for the WWE, they'll take care of your drug rehab. They'll all expenses paid or whatever. And yeah, they get the press that how, you know, how nice it is for them to do it. But I mean, they should have to. It's sad that they it's a voluntary thing, regardless of whether they are choosing to do it or not.
What's so incredibly screwed up about this business is that the only reason I even believe that it's not a work is that, and that these things, that there's an actual commitment to wellness, is that we have less dead bodies than we were having in the 2000s.
Right. Mm. What were we going to say, Scarlett?
I was just going to say, they should be looking at the issues that cause wrestlers to become drug addicted in the first place. Like, you know, let's nip it in the bud at the beginning.
It is baffling to me that there hasn't ever been a push, even with the draft. For those who don't know, the WWE is now split. Every now and then they go back to this thing called the draft, where they split up the two shows, Raw and SmackDown, into two separate rosters. So there's wrestlers who only work on Raw and Raw shows, and wrestlers who only work on SmackDown and SmackDown shows. And it's baffling to me that no one has been like, I guess I know why, because they don't want them to do it. And if you go bring this idea to Vince, I'm sure that's a real nice way to get fired real quick. But there's no push to ever have an off season for at least half the roster at a time. So the WWE could continue, you know, if they're so worried about making money, they could continue making all this money by having 52 weeks of shows every year. But there could be a roster who has a few months off every season. So that they're continuing the company as a whole, but certain guys can, you know, get a break. They're on the road all the time.
And that would solve their creative issues as well, with having such a deep roster and half of the roster just sits around backstage and never gets TV time. And, you know, the dissatisfaction of the fans with, like, the storylines, you know, it would freshen things up a bit as well.
Absolutely. For sure. I mean, we know why, because they're making more money doing what they're doing, but they could continue.
Well, I mean, the reason for the split rosters, I believe, in the first place was to be able to run two distinct crews of live events at the same time and make more money from live events. But they haven't even ever flirted with, like, the Japanese system where it's a few weeks on, a few weeks off, which... You can't really say how much it would or wouldn't affect people because of the Japanese style being, you know, rougher physically, and also that the Japanese mentality is more to work through injuries. So you can't really make a comparison of how well that would work. But even then, you know, in the 90s when, and I mean, it's going back in that direction a little bit, but in the 90s when, you know, you can make as much money, you know, just working half the year in Japan as you know, and having a lot of time off as you could, you know, working for WWE or WCW, even with the harder style, the guys who were making their living in Japan felt they had a much higher quality of life.
Right. So let's talk about, so every year before WrestleMania, the WWE has a Hall of Fame ceremony where they induct way too many people, in my opinion. It's ridiculous how fast they're going through all these guys, just inducting them in the Hall of Fame. However, even as they're this year's Hall of Fame, I think all but one person is from the Attitude Era, the late 90s, early 2000s. Hillbilly Jim is the only person.
Hillbilly Jim, yeah.
They're just going through. Like, what are they going to do in, like, 5 years, maybe even less, when everybody's in the Hall of Fame? Even, like, watch, Roman Reigns gets inducted in, like, 3 years because they're just running out of people, and he's still active.
Or they'll put in Uncle Elmer and Cousin Junior to just round out the Hillbilly Jim posse.
Right.
Well, they really screwed it up the year, the last time they were in New York that we were talking about earlier with Trump, because they decided to load it up with basically all, like, main event level inductees.
Yeah. It was Mick Foley and Trish as well, yeah?
It was Mick Foley, Bruno Sammartino, Bob Backlund, Mick Foley, Trish Stratus, Booker T,
Scott Hall,
Trump. Scott Hall wasn't New York.
Jake.
My bad.
No, it wasn't.
No, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, I think
that's like the heaviest, like, star power class, like, ever.
All of them, other than maybe Backlund, could headline a Hall of Fame on their own.
Right. And the reason I'm bringing this up, though, is as we're going through all these people who are getting into the Hall of Fame, and as they're running out of the well-known people of the 80s and 90s, early 90s, you know, the people who most grew up watching during the wrestling boom period, there's someone who they can easily induct who is sadly no longer with us. And the reasoning behind they're not inducting her, to me, is one of the most screwed up things I've ever heard, especially when you consider some of the people who have been inducted. And the person I'm talking about is Joni Lawler, a.k.a. China.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a history between her and Triple H. They were in a long relationship, and, you know, what happened with her and leaving the WWE and Triple H, basically, that relationship ending because Triple H started a relationship with Stephanie, the boss's daughter.
I need to make an interjection about that briefly.
Sure.
Before any of that was even, like, known publicly, as if by chance, somehow, my dad worked with someone who lived in the same apartment building in Manhattan as Stephanie McMahon. And one day he saw Triple H come over. So I knew about that before China did, which is sad, as I was a, we're talking the year 2000, so I was a 15-year-old kid who somehow knew this before she did, which is sad and awful.
Oh, wow.
Damn.
Now, okay, so we have the relationship down, but you might know Joni Lawler from her time after wrestling. You know, she was all over TMZ for many years. Very sad case. She was, I'm not sure what exactly it was, but clearly she was addicted to some sort of drugs. And she struggled in her life after leaving wrestling and her relationship that, you know, her whole life was, you know, built upon this. And just like that, just done. And, you know, one of the few people who gained that star power in wrestling to just be basically erased from wrestling history, the WWE's wrestling history, let me add. And really, she didn't do anything wrong. It's not like, you know, like a Chris Benoit where you murdered your family and committed suicide and you know, the terrible something. She didn't do anything. And she ended up in a relationship with X-Pac, Triple H's friend, and there was a sex tape there that got released. And then using the press and the media coverage from that sex tape, got into a career in porn. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's other people in wrestling who have done this stuff, including X-Pac, who was in that sex tape with China, who have been on WWE TV since and before. Like not long after this sex tape was released, X-Pac was always, he was never banned from WWE. And in an interview on the WWE Network, what was it, maybe 2, 3, 4 max, maybe years ago?
It was relatively early in WWE Network. It ended up being the catalyst for China coming back to the States because she was attempting to live in Japan in anonymity as an English teacher.
Right. And so,
are we talking about a Triple H interview?
Yes, you want to talk about that? You want to bring that up, Scarlett?
Yeah, so I think it was 2014, and it was on the Stone Cold podcast, but like they were doing live, like, you know, video podcasts on the network. And yeah, Triple H said, and actually I can probably, because I did write about it at the time, so I can probably find like the exact transcript. Hang on, sorry, guys. I'll just find it. But, yeah, he basically said, like, you know, in a nutshell, that China wouldn't be inducted into the Hall of Fame because Google is a thing. And he didn't, like, you know, they didn't want kids.
He said his kids, didn't he?
Yes, I think he did use that as the example.
I mean, he did literally cite that this was his ex-girlfriend, effectively.
Yeah. So, okay, I've got it here. Thanks for sending it through Bix. All right.
You're
finding my own work than I am. Okay, here we go. I've got an 8-year-old kid, and my 8-year-old kid sees the Hall of Fame, and my 8-year-old kid goes on the internet to look at, you know, there's China. I've never heard of her. I'm 8 years old. I've never heard of her. So I go and put that in. I punch it up, and what comes up? And I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm not criticizing lifestyle choices. Everybody has their reasons, and I don't know what they were, and I don't care to know. It's not a morality thing or anything else. It's just the fact of what it is, and that's a difficult choice. The Hall of Fame is a funny thing, that it is not as simple as this guy had a really, really good career, a legendary career. He could go into the Hall of Fame. Yeah, but we can't because of this reason. We can't because of this legal instance. And also, the Hall of Fame is not a real thing.
But I forgot about that last line. That literally has nothing to do with anything else he said.
Hmm. Yeah, so, you know, obviously there are personal reasons there, and that's clear in that interview. And, I mean, that was 4 years ago, and I think we've been talking about China being inducted into the Hall of Fame and just sort of like the injustices around how she was treated during her time in WWE. And since then that you know, the conversation around it has gotten a bit more sophisticated. But yeah, like it's in the frame of like the women's evolution and the whole Fabulous Moolah Battle Royal clusterfuck, like, it's like you want to name a women's battle royal after an alleged like pimp and like abuser of women, but you won't let this woman who did like a couple of pornos into the Hall of Fame. It's ridiculous.
Even more directly, I mean, it's perfect. That's perfect. Even more directly, Sunny is in the Hall of Fame, and she's had her own same things pretty much.
And she was inducted before, though, for whatever it is or isn't worth.
Yeah, but also she goes on like racist rants on Twitter and stuff, and you know Hulk Hogan was removed from the Hall of Fame for his public racism. So it's like, you know,
but was he really removed from the Hall of Fame? Though?
I mean, it's just basically from the website. I don't think WWE has ever said one way or another as if they actually considered him removed from the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, they just took him off the website. They didn't, like, take back his ring. There is no physical Hall of Fame to remove him from. It's not like they were, like, they made an announcement that we retract Hulk Hogan's Hall of Fame.
They didn't have Howard Finkel come out and say, we retract Hulk Hogan's Hall of Fame induction. Right.
Now, I want to get into, you brought up the women's wrestling revolution, but I know, Dave, Zyron, you have to leave soon?
Well, I probably have a hard out in the next 5 minutes or so. But
okay, so let me quickly. I want to cover a topic that you want to cover, and then we'll get back to the women's wrestling revolution when you jump off.
I want to talk about the women's wrestling revolution. That sounds amazing. Okay. Unless you were going to ask Scarlett, the greatest wrestler to ever come out of Australia, which I'm actually really interested.
Oh, right. We still got. All right, so go ahead.
Oh God.
I mean,
it's the Bushwhackers.
I want to say Cactus Jack.
Oh wait, but that's New Zealand, right? They're not.
I think, I think they are from
New Zealand.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's the same thing to me. I'm sorry.
What does Cactus Jack have to do with Australia? You meant Outback Jack. So how do you say Cactus Jack?
I'm sorry. I meant Outback Jack.
If Mick Foley's from Australia, then I'm pretty much Australian myself. I'm only probably
like
an hour away from him.
Australian wrestlers, as Scarlett was talking before, and I thought I saw Samoa Joe for a second, and I freaked out, but it was the Samoan Joe.
Oh, God. All right, well, I'm going to say just someone who I can think of off the top of my head, not based on any, deep research into the topic, but I'm going to say Toni Storm. She was in the Mae Young Classic semifinal, I think.
I don't remember. I feel terrible. I don't remember.
I think she faced...
She was the one with the funny hat.
Yeah, and the she's sort of like Slash, but a woman.
I remember.
Yeah, I think she was in the semifinals against who was the one that won it?
Blonde, right?
Oh, Kairi Sane.
Yes, yeah, I think Kairi Sane beat her in the semifinals. So,
wow, so she's better than Emma. The only other Australian woman I could think of.
Look, this is just, you know, this, as I said, this isn't the be-all, end-all of who's the best Australian wrestler, but, you know, I like her. She's up there.
Is Wikipedia wrong here, or is this true? Nia Jax is Australian?
She was born in Australia, apparently.
That's Australia.
I was reading an article with her this weekend, and it was like, blah, 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 Nia Jax from Australia. And I was like, no, she's just born here. Like, she's not from here.
That's Australia.
I think her dad was, like, in the army or something.
Right. And where would you rank Nathan Jones on the best?
however many Australian wrestlers there are, and then him.
He's definitely the best lactating male Australian wrestler.
All right, so with Nathan Jones lactating, where are we going to go with this? The women's wrestling revolution? No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great segue, dude.
All right, so let's talk about it though, because it's all right, to me, there's some incredible stuff that have come out of it, and there's some incredibly disappointing stuff that have come out of it.
Yeah.
I think the wrestling is there. I've always actually thought that there's just something about a women's wrestling match, and I that, you know, when you get two actual women wrestlers who love the sport and weren't just, you know, models in a magazine that Kevin Dunn picked out, you know, you have probably one of the most emotionally invested wrestling matches there are. I think the Sasha Banks Bayley match at that NXT TakeOver, the first one in Brooklyn, is probably one of the greatest modern examples of just how much better actually women's wrestling can be than men's wrestling.
Mm. No, yeah, Dave here. I agree with that 5,000%. And I think what's been disheartening, it's hard for me to de-link what's been disheartening about women's wrestling in the WWE in 2018 with just general problems all over the place in terms of how they tell stories and how they keep falling back on old tropes instead of trying to develop new narratives. And so that's been the toughest part, because in NXT, I mean, how could you not just fall head over heels for the incredible athleticism of everybody from Becky Lynch and Charlotte and Bayley, as you mentioned, and Sasha Banks. And then when it comes up to the main roster, it's just not what I thought it could be. And but there's so much that's not, like I mentioned Big E before, there's so much that there's not what I think it could be when you look at the potential and the athleticism and the talent that runs all across this roster.
Right. And in many, I thought honestly that Bayley in NXT, I thought honestly that she, that character alone, was going to bring about a new era of pro wrestling when she got called up that was going to be unlike anything the WWE has ever seen. I literally thought she was going to be as big as John Cena, as big as Hulk Hogan, as big as The Rock or Stone Cold. I thought she was going to be that for everyone, not just girls who love her and women. I thought she really, because that character in NXT was so good, and you just felt so emotionally invested in this underdog story of hers. And then they just brought her to the main roster and they just ruined her. And there's just, it's at the point where, like, I still like her so much, but I can't see how there's coming back from what they've done with her. It's almost like she's been ruined, like her character's been ruined for good.
Damn.
I mean, say what you want about him, but, and we have, but maybe Triple H should be writing the main shows as well.
Right. Well, I think one of the biggest problems is there's been a women's wrestling revolution in terms of how we actually have great women's wrestlers now able to go out there and show what they've got with their wrestling skill, their charisma, their on-mic abilities, their, you know, what they've trained all their life to do, and they're given the shot to show that off. But who are the people writing for them? It's still men. And that's why I think a lot of the failure in the women's wrestling storylines and angles, it's all in the writing right now to me, when it comes to the main roster at least. It's just so bad, and it's ruining them. It's ruining their characters. It's ruining their storylines. Like, how many times are we going to just get – there's literally been a variation of two different storylines when it comes to the women. Either – two best friends now hate each other, or this girl's just a crazy bitch.
Mm.
Like, that's all there. Like, how many times have we seen, like, there was a time where both AJ Lee and Paige were on the roster together, and they were both supposed to be crazy. We had the crazy angle going on for two women, and it was basically just explained like that. They're just crazy. And then Alicia Fox came over too, so that might be three people.
Yeah, or the trend in the last year or so to sort of bring back the, like, romantic storylines of the Attitude Era. So, like, Nia Jax and Enzo and Alicia Fox and her love triangle with Noam Dar and Cedric Alexander. And, I guess Alexa Bliss and Braun Strowman from the Mixed Match Challenge as well.
Right. Oh, come on. Alexa Bliss and Braun Strowman's awesome, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's the exception to the rule. But and sort of Mixed Match Challenge exists in its own little universe on its own anyway. Like, things that happen in that aren't then sort of brought back up on the main roster. So it's kind of, they're sort of heading in an okay direction with that. But going back to your earlier point, Dave Zirin, that Big E, you mentioned Big E when we were began talking about the women's evolution. I wrote an article about a year or so ago about how WWE needs quotas, and I think that would solve its problem both in representation on screen and who's writing the stories behind the scenes. More women, more people of color, more perspectives that's actually going to honor what they think this women's evolution is supposed to be. Not men deciding that women can wrestle now, but, you know, better, more storylines, a breadth of storylines, and just giving them the chance to actually show what they can do.
And the last I remember hearing when it came up was that there was literally just one female member of the writing team and not in any of the senior roles. To their credit, they have put at least a few women in the wrestling producer roles with, I think there might be more now, but I know Sarah Amato and Sarah Stock are both now working as wrestling producers, and not just for the women either. They're producing some of the men's matches too. So that is a positive step at least, but it doesn't seem like there's been any kind of change on the writing side. No.
No. And that's obvious.
Yeah. I would say the biggest positive in terms, in a weird way, of how the winner presented, and that helps make at least the in-ring more compelling than the men a lot of the time, is I don't know, like, why it is this way necessarily. Because, you know, WWE's biggest fault in terms of in-ring is that it can feel very sanitized. With the women, it does not. For whatever reason, the women's matches are generally, for one reason or another, more violent in a good way than the men's. And it makes their stuff more, like, even more compelling. But it also makes me wonder, like, what is their reason that they're giving them a longer leash in the ring while also kind of not committing to them in other ways?
Right. When we were bringing up like the typical tropes of wrestling, and you just brought up, you know, like the emotional investment in the match, the characters and the build up, I always think about the Trish Stratus Mickey James match at that WrestleMania, where, to me, in my opinion, I know that's not where the women's wrestling revolution started, but I think that match and the time given to them and what they were able to pull off in that match, to me, was the start of something. And Mickey James and Trish Stratus, the angle was, you know, Mickey James is, Trish Stratus is crazy. Here we go again with this. But, you know, if it works.
Crazy lesbian stalker.
Right. But they owned it. It was like they were given this and they were like, you know what? We're going to take this and we're going to do it so good that people are going to, you know, I think of that WrestleMania and that's the first match I think of. Because the crowd, I've never seen the crowd so invested in a women's wrestling match up until that point. I've never seen the flip that usually happens in men's matches at these big pay-per-views, where the crowd comes in loving one wrestler and leaves loving the opponent instead. And that match to me was so good with the story they told. And was it the ideal story? Obviously not. But they were like, you know what? This is what we're given. This is what we're going to do. And we're gonna just like kill it. And I think it was one of the greatest women's wrestling matches in terms of maybe not wrestling wise, but just the storytelling, where they just took the fans and they were like, listen, you're going to care about this match. Maybe nobody agrees with me.
That ends up being one of the very best matches at that WrestleMania. And that's a real good WrestleMania too.
To me, it just all comes down to really the storylines and the angles right now when it comes to the women's wrestling. And of course, we didn't even touch upon Stephanie McMahon somehow taking credit for it all. Unbelievable there.
You know what we should mention, though, just before we get away from, I guess, the Mickey James for Stratus thing, that we should also say, though, that even though they did kind of, you know, put on these amazing performances and kind of take ownership of this, you know, less than ideal, to say the least, storyline, they were also, you know, they were kind of used as props in this storyline that it seems like I was told by someone who was there that Vince McMahon wasn't involved, but, you know, suddenly after Vince McMahon is accused of groping a tanning salon employee, there's a storyline where Mickey James, you know, they show enough on camera to we know that she is falsely accusing Trish Stratus's new love interest of groping her.
I forgot about that. Again, this is not the greatest storyline ever, but my point was just that, you know, this was an era where they didn't have the opportunity that the current women's roster have, and they were, you know, Trish was someone who was treated so horribly by that company, and and I mean, yes, she went along with it all, and she you know, she had to pretty much, and I think she really ended up being someone who had no real wrestling experience, being, I mean, everyone probably agrees, probably one of the most significant women's wrestlers in professional wrestling history. If, you know, I think that's undeniable. Again, maybe wrestling wise, not as talented as the current roster, but she definitely was her, Lita, Mickey James, some of the lesser, the women who were given lesser credit, like Victoria and Ivory, although Ivory's getting credit in the Hall of Fame this year. Like, they really were in an era where their wrestling skills were not seen as a plus. It was just there.
Yeah. And she also doesn't always get the credit she's due from fans, too, because I don't know why people don't realize this. She trained to be a wrestler before she ever signed with WWE. She didn't have any matches, but her goal was always to be a wrestler.
I didn't know that, actually. Really? I didn't know that. Wow.
I mean, she had been a fitness model beforehand, and that was what got her on WWE and WCW's radar. But, yeah, no, she trained to be a wrestler at Sully's Gym, where Edge, Christian, Gail Kim, Rhino, people like that all trained, before she ever signed, with the intention of ending up becoming a pro wrestler. Yeah.
All right. Now, Zyron, Dave Zyron, do you have to go? Or do you have time for maybe one more?
I should go, but I'm having too much fun. So throw one more at me, and I'd love it.
All right, because I feel like this is something. I think you're older than the rest of the people on this this podcast, and I feel like you would have a different perspective maybe than us on this particular individual. And how the WWE likes to remember Luthez. Him. Who?
Luthez.
I don't think you're that old.
No, I'm not that old.
I would like to talk about how the WWE has rewritten the life and times of the Ultimate Warrior.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's to say about the Ultimate Warrior? I mean, first and foremost, I remember him when he was a Dingo Warrior in WCCW, and he was really cool. I mean, that's undeniable, because I'm sure it's very much of a fashion to just talk about his in-ring work as trash, because he didn't do too much other than be this incredibly vibrant, charismatic person, and drop people on their stomachs and then do some lame splash on their back. And he was the Ultimate Warrior. I mean, the name itself is corny as hell. But when he was Dingo Warrior in WCCW, you had this feeling that you were watching something different. And that's one of the coolest things about wrestling. Like, when you see somebody new and you say to yourself, not just, oh, this is a new person, this is something new in the sport. Like, the first time I saw Ricochet, who I'm so excited is going to be at NXT Saturday night, WrestleMania weekend, as part of that North American title ladder match. But, like, you see somebody like that, and you say to yourself, well, this is something that I really have not seen before. Dante Fox, I feel that way about, and Lucha Underground. And it's really cool. And that's what it was first seeing him. And then when he goes into WWE, comes the Ultimate Warrior. And then he becomes somebody who's on YouTube talking racist conspiracy theories, basically. I mean, maybe alt-right before it was alt-right, alt-right before it was fashionable. I don't know how we want to describe it. And then the story was that he found God, found his family, had kids, turned into this other person, and it looked like WWE was going to find some sort of permanent ceremonial role for him, and fans were eating it up. There's no question about it. And then he he died. Simple as that. I mean, I'm leaving a lot out with the narrative here, but they're very selective in an almost Stalinist Russia fashion as to whose history they erase and whose history they glorify, who we're told to remember, who we're told to forget. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I'm attracted to this industry, because it's all of that reality show machinations, the game within the game, who they want us to remember, who they don't want us to remember. I just find all of that as fascinating sometimes as what happens inside the ring.
Right. That's a great way to put it. Ultimate Warrior was alt-right before alt-right was the thing. Like, I remember the quote, but I wanted to see where he said it. In 2005, he's already way out of the WWE at this point. His last wrestling experience on a mainstream stage, at least, was probably WCW in the very early 2000s. So he's been out of the wrestling limelight.
Longer. That was 98.
Right. Wow.
Ow.
Wow. Jeez. I always just seem to forget just how early in the 2000s WCW closed. But so in 2005 at UConn, at a Young Republicans event, so, you know, of course they invited him because they know what he's going to say. You know, he says this, he says, queering don't make the world work during this, you know, he's going at this anti-LGBT screed. And then to me, probably one of the most messed up things he ever said was this thing he wrote on his blog on his website after Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, God.
Do you guys remember that?
Let me see if I can find it, because I've pulled up I have it. Oh, you have the Ultimate Warriors.
I was making sure you guys remember this, because this was...
Okay.
If we could be shown what general conditions they lived in before the hurricane, we would see they had little respect for what they did have. We would see just how unorganized, unclean, and dysfunctionally they lived. They never gave a care for order, cleanliness, or function before, but now that they could get someone's attention who will possibly take over the responsibility of their life for them, they go on these tirades about how their life has been ruined. Their lives were already in ruin, self-ruin, ruined by the bad choices they made over and over. He continues, and they are fat. This is a couple paragraphs later, and they are fat. Have you ever seen so many fat people? Poverty, poverty of what? Having enough to buy so much food to eat that you become obese? He just goes on and on, 200, talking about designer clothes made by rap stars, $200 Nikes, free medicine and medical care if you really need it. Just, and then do we call the scenes they shoot out of Africa that they use to lay guilt trips down on all of us? Just unbelievably racist stuff.
He could have been president.
Right.
Although, you know what we should say, even if he's a lot more descriptive and colorful about it, in spirit, this is not that different from what Barbara Bush said at the time.
Damn.
Right.
But, yeah, when you really look at, I mean, I forget the exact phrasing, but she was talking about the people who were being sheltered in the Superdome, and she said something like, well, if, you know, I think if you consider, you know, where they were before, I think they're doing quite well right now.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. Wow.
Hey, everyone.
That was a bumper harvest for racism after Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
It's really something, because I know a lot of time, I know we decry today for all the bigotry, but Hurricane Katrina, that's pretty much when I was starting as a sports writer, and the timidity of athletes to say something at that time about the racism, even though a disproportionate number of them were from the Gulf region and New Orleans, that you know, this idea that we can do more than just community service was still a bridge too far for so many athletes. And the racism was so intense at that time that, you know, in some ways we're in a better place now, even if in other ways we're in a worse place. The worst place is that if something like that happened now, well, actually it did just happen in Puerto Rico, and somebody said Donald Trump doesn't care about brown people, Donald Trump would, you know, George Bush apparently was deeply offended when Kanye said that about him. If that was said about Donald Trump, he would just say, you know, your point being what?
Right. With Ultimate Warrior, it's just something where it's like, you know, this guy, man, he goes out there, he says these things, and just how easily they're able to just sweep it under the rug because of this, almost, you can't write the story that happened there where he has this huge falling out of WWE, gone for decades, comes back, has this big Hall of Fame moment, embraces Vince for the first time in just as many years, and then comes on Raw, basically gives this speech that sounds like the final speech you would have if you knew you were going to die, and then drops dead on the way home from that wrestling event that very night.
Well, we should also point out that, like, especially with hindsight and comparing how he had looked a few months earlier when they showed the documentary of him, you know, making the deal and stuff. He, with hindsight, he probably was having a heart attack throughout that whole weekend.
Damn.
Because he was bloated and purple.
He was in bad shape. I remember seeing him come down the ramp to give that speech on that Raw the night after WrestleMania and thinking to myself, holy, like, there's people in their 70s who come out to do wrestling stuff, like, things. Dusty Rhodes, well, I think he was, like, late 60s, but you know, right. Dusty Rhodes, Ric Flair, I think we've probably seen people who are even older make it down to the ring in better shape than Ultimate Warrior did, and he was, what, 52?
Yeah, I mean, he was walking like a guy who had taken, and I'm not trying to trivialize whatever bumps he took in wrestling, but all things considered, given the relative brevity of his career and that he didn't do a lot of, you know, up and down in the ring, he would not be a massively physically broken down guy. And then, you know, all of a sudden, and then you see just a month or two earlier, he looks much better. It's like, yeah. And then, oh, even when he got in the ring and was doing that speech, he got winded trying to do his shaking of the ropes right away. It was weird, and then, you know, all of a sudden he drops dead, and, you know, Barry Pachevsky at Deadspin making sure to remind people that, you know, if you want to Google it, the title is The Ultimate Warrior Was an Insane Dick.
Right.
And he, in the Hall of Fame speech, I mean, really, to get back around to what we're talking about in the first place, he had mentioned in this speech, went back and forth, a lot of positive, not a lot of negative, nothing really resembling the alt-right Ultimate Warrior public speaker character, but still, one of the nicer things was he remembers talking about how hardworking WWE's old, you know, since deceased head of merchandise, Jimmy Miranda, was. And he said he would like WWE to do, as part of the Hall of Fame, a Jimmy Miranda Award to recognize, you know, backstage employees and people like that who had made contributions but wouldn't really have gotten, you know, public attention before. And it's a nice sentiment. After he dies, they edit and find, like, a clip to make it the Warrior Award that they're going to give to non-wrestling people who they find inspiring. Which, it's weird, too. It's like, so you're honoring him when you really shouldn't be, but you're also not following his actual wish.
Right, the one moment of actual sincere kindness from Ultimate Warrior. He wants to give a little bit of credit to the people backstage who make everything happen, who don't get any recognition. And the WWE is like, oh, we can't recognize those. We can't recognize our own employees.
Right. And then, now, the theory I like about this, which I'll credit my friend Sean Rossap, who I believe is official title's managing editor of Fightful.com, he thinks it's possible that this is kind of one long, weird, posthumous troll of Warrior by WWE, because you look at the people who he took shots at on his website and stuff. Bobby Heenan when he had cancer, and Darren Drozdov, who, you know, it was paralyzed in a wrestling accident in a wheelchair and called him a cripple. You know, the cancer stuff, and then you get the idea. So far, the Warrior Award recipients have been two cancer patients, one posthumously, a paralyzed man in a wheelchair, and now a black child who is a transplant recipient. And if you want to play with the Katrina stuff, you know, and fit that in, whatever. Like, there's been enough that, like, you can fit into, like, being part of groups that he would have hated, that you can sort of see that argument for being,
I would love so much if that was true, but just knowing this company, it's not. Come on.
I know, it doesn't actually seem like something they would do, like, in this fashion, at least. Like, they would do something to troll someone, I mean, maybe even after they died, but not necessarily in this fashion, no.
Right. Interesting note that you brought up Draws, though. I was there for that match where he broke his neck.
Oh, at the Coliseum, really?
Yes, I saw it happen. And that image has been ingrained in my, that happened in 99. I was 13 years old, and I will never get, like, it's not, no one's seen the video, but I know what happened. I've seen what happened. And it's just something that it's stuck with me. And it's like, just horrible. 'Cause you know what happens to the guy. They've done follow-ups with him, you know, and just, it's just a sad, sad story. This guy, former NFL player, turned pro wrestler. He was in Beyond the Mat, that big wrestling documentary in the late 90s, where they showed him pitching his character to Vince. And then he was in the WWE and never really got a chance to really shine or anything. And then just this one-off match with D'Lo Brown at this SmackDown event at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. And I saw the move that botched. And it was just a move that D'Lo always did. And just what happened was so ridiculous, like not ridiculous, but like just so like unassuming. Like, it was just something that you would never expect someone to, their life to be forever changed from that move.
Which is, you mean it didn't actually look that bad in the moment?
No, it looked like, I'm telling you, this is what it looked like. So he's going for that. Remember, D'Lo would go to the corner and do that running power bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets Drives for the running power bomb, and he's picking up Drives, and all of a sudden, about midway through, you see Drives' hands. His arms extended out, and he's flailing, like trying to give himself a little bit of balance, I guess, to try to lift himself with D'Lo. Mm-hmm. And D'Lo's legs sort of slips out from under him, and Draz sort of takes the move like a Styles Clash. But his head is not obviously tucked the right way for a Styles Clash, because he's trying to lift himself up for the powerbomb.
Right. Well, the Styles Clash is the only move that you tuck your head for. That's why some wrestlers have gotten injured by it, is because
you don't tuck your head for the Styles Clash.
No, you're right. You're right. No, you're right. I'm saying it wrong.
Yeah.
You tuck your head for everything else. You don't tuck your head for the Styles Clash.
So,
right.
So basically what happens is D'Lo's, Draz's body is halfway up. Like literally like his head is extended out, completely horizontal from D'Lo's stomach, I guess you can say. And D'Lo falls straight forward onto his stomach. And D'Lo gets up, taunts the crowd, and honestly, it looked like a botch, but I did not think that anyone was injured from it. And then D'Lo continues to taunt the crowd. He goes over to Drives to, like, go get him, and the ref tells him, like, no, 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 no. And literally for, like, 30 minutes, people are sitting there, and Drives does not move. And it's like, it was just something I will never forget at 13 years old, seeing this guy break his neck. And it was just crazy, man. It was just something that, yeah, you see the stories afterwards where they follow up with him, and his, you know, his wife ends up leaving him. And I mean, I can't say anything there, because it's, you know, you don't know the personal, what's going on there in their personal life. And I think WWE ends up affording him a house that he has to have, you know, one of those wheelchair elevators in every floor or wherever to get him to everywhere. He's paralyzed from the neck down, I believe. I think in recent years, I think now he's got some movement.
I believe from the beginning it was just low enough that it was from the chest down.
Right.
So he had limited use of his arms, I think, fairly early on. So it could have been worse, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, just a crazy thing to see at 13, and I the image is in my head forever. But yeah, okay, all right. I mean, I know, Dave, I know we've held you way too long.
But this was so much fun. Please have me back on if you want, like, a tangential mark to hear you talk about wrestling.
I want to have each one of you guys on again. Just, you know, I had this idea for this multiple person conversation for WrestleMania week. I think we pulled it together pretty well. I think everyone got to talk, and we all have said some interesting things. I really enjoyed it, but I'd love to just focus on each one of you guys and what you guys have to say about this crazy sport of ours. And it's good to see people, you know, write about it from this perspective, because I think wrestling is going in a direction that most people who are outside this world don't know it's moving in. And I think it's a real positive thing in terms of seeing, you know, women, African-Americans, black people outside of African-Americans, you know, Asian people, Latino people, the LGBT community. Everyone's really starting to in both on-screen portrayal, the people working for the company, even the wrestlers who aren't, this younger generation of pro wrestlers is, you know, just look at Daniel Bryan, people like, you know, him, Seth Rollins, Sasha Banks, incredibly progressive just from following them on Twitter, you know. I remember some of the things some of these guys said when Trump won the election. It's it's a real positive moment in pro wrestling, and I thank you guys for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, so let me just run down all you guys. Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Follow him at Edge of Sports. Scarlett Harris, if you couldn't tell, she's an Australian freelance writer with a focus on pro wrestling. Her website is scarletwoman.com.au. I didn't even get to talk to you about, read that great article you recently wrote about how Ronda Rousey is actually sort of ruining the women's wrestling revolution moment.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to have you on
that one day.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to have you on just talk about that. Follow her at Scarlett E. Harris, and then David Bixenspan, pro wrestling writer at Deadspin, co-host of Between the Sheets podcast. Follow him at David Bix. Guys, WrestleMania is this Sunday. Hope you all enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Can you dig it, sucker?